I'm your host, Robert Rogers, and this is the Parkinson's Recovery Radio Network. Earlier this year, Deborah attended a quite fascinating seminar course that was given by naturopath Dr. Kristen Allott. And I must say, she came back and we spent the rest of the evening talking about some of the amazing and incredible suggestions that Dr. Allott gave during that particular training session. I immediately, and I must say the next day, gave her a call, and we have been talking about setting up this show today so that you too can begin to get some of these amazing suggestions of what you can do to address the challenges of depression and anxiety and other anxiety disorders naturally, in a way that has absolutely no side effects. Dr. Allott is, I am pleased and proud and excited to say, is my guest on the show today. Dr. Allott, thank you so much for being with us today.
Robert, I'm so pleased that you invited me on. It's really quite an honor to come and speak to your audiences and speak to you. And what a lovely introduction. Thank you very much.
Tell everybody about yourself.
So I am a naturopathic physician and an acupuncturist in Seattle, Washington. So my private practice is non-pharmaceutical interventions for depression, anxiety, addictions, and other mental health concerns, and pre-diabetes and diabetes with people who have mental health concerns, which is way too long of a tagline, but because I'm kind of in this unique niche where I'm covering the territory that therapists, psychiatrists, and general care physicians aren't covering for patients with mental health. And a lot of what I do happens to be nutrition, because a lot of who I see are people who are on a great deal of pharmaceutical meds for mental health. So I am particularly interested in the brain, and that's where and how we manage stress, and that's sort of where the overlay may be with Parkinson's, and certainly a lot of overlay will be with people who are caregivers, because being a caregiver can be very stressful, and there can be a lot of anxiety and potentially depression that goes along with that.
The month of November is actually Caregivers Month, and caregivers are often obviously fatigued and anxious. Are there things that they can do to help themselves feel better?
There are. One of the things that I sort of discovered through my patients who came to see me, you know, they would come in on 5 or 6 psychotropic meds. And, you know, the usual fare for naturopaths in terms of 5-HTP or St. John's wort just wasn't available. And so I started feeding people. And what I found is that when people ate small, frequent meals with protein in it, they had less fatigue, less anxiety, and slept better. And part of, and I can explain the physiology if you would like me to, because often we've heard that message before: eat small, frequent meals, eat protein. I mean, it's sort of out there, but nobody really explains why that works. And so, what I found is my patients didn't listen to it. Would it be helpful for me to explain why that's an important concept?
Please do.
Thank you. So what I found is when I travel nationally and I talk to people, what I find is that generally they will skip breakfast altogether, or they will have toast, a scone, a muffin, a bagel for breakfast, or cereal, which is primarily carbohydrates. And when we have primarily carbohydrates, our blood glucose will go up and insulin will go up. In about 1.5 to 2 hours, insulin will sweep the glucose out of our bloodstream and into cells, and our blood glucose will drop. Now, if, you know, 10,000 years ago, that wouldn't be a big problem if we were walking 5 miles to get water. But if you're a caregiver, or you're working a stressful job, or you have a mental health concern, your brain is working really hard to make sure that everything's okay. And that consumes a lot of glucose. And when the glucose starts to get low, the brain goes, wow, I don't have the fuel in order to think this much. And then we'll send a signal down to the kidneys to say, I'm getting in trouble here, and there's some hormones that will be released. But one of the hormones that is released is adrenaline. And adrenaline then goes up to the brain and triggers the amygdala, which is the fight, flight, disappear, or play the old record part of our brain. And so now we, all of our decisions are going to be made from a panicked point of view. And it depends on if we're an anxious person or we're an irritated person, if we go to anxious or irritated. And if it's too high, if the signal is too high or there is too much stress on top of that, we will disappear. What is disappear? Disappear is sometimes humans, some people know that it's freeze in other animals. In humans, we disappear into a bag of potato chips, a pint of Ben and Jerry's ice cream, television, alcohol, Facebook, where we are emotionally shut down and we are no longer participating or problem solving. Does that make sense?
It does indeed.
So when we eat small, frequent meals, what happens that have protein in it is when we have, say, 2 eggs and a piece of toast and an apple for breakfast instead of cereal, then our blood glucose is stable for 3 to 4 hours, which means that we may have the same amount of stress. It's not changing the exterior stress. What it's doing is changing how our body and our brain reacts to the stress. And then our mind, which is not our brain, can better make decisions. And so when people are stressed out and they're coming in to see me and they're fatigued, I will say, well, why don't you eat small, frequent meals with protein in them every 3 to 4 hours? And you have to start within an hour of waking, because otherwise your body has to manage your fuel regulation. And so when they do that, they typically come back and they say, wow, I'm not as fatigued, particularly in the afternoons. I'm not as anxious. I'm certainly not as hungry, because if we don't, when we have carbohydrates and our blood glucose drops, we have a choice. We can either go get candy, which is my favorite way of responding to that, or we think to ourselves, no, I don't want to get candy because I'm trying to lose weight, and so we ignore it, and then we just get more and more anxious. And so what I want people to do is get out of that routine by eating protein at breakfast and then maybe having a little bit of nuts before lunch, some midday, mid-morning, and then having a little bit of meat for lunch, and then maybe a spoonful of cottage cheese at a snack, and then a few slices of meat again at dinner. And often they report that they have less fatigue and less mood issues, which then gives us the energy to get the things we need to get done and problem solve the things we need to problem solve.
Because I had the advantage of hearing and learning about your ideas about 6 months ago, I've had an opportunity to put them into action. a challenge I have personally had is a bit of low energy, even depression, that seems to creep in every afternoon about 2 o'clock or 2:30. I want you to know that when I eat more regularly and when I try to add protein to these meals that are more frequent, that doesn't happen.
Wow, that's awesome. Can I ask you a few questions?
Of course.
But was it hard to change your diet?
It was not hard when I realized that the benefits were that I didn't have that slump in energy, which was really, really irritating me because I'd be ready to work, ready to write, ready to do what I really love to do. And then, again, I'd have this incredible slump of about 2 hours. I'd rebound usually, but it really felt quite yucky. So I did have the motivation. My one challenge, and it really continues to be a challenge, is first thing in the morning, I can't really make myself eat anything when I first get up. So it's usually, I know you're supposed to get in there within an hour. Sometimes it's longer than that. Sometimes it's 2 hours, could even be 2.5 or 3 when I finally say, okay, I think I can actually eat something. That's the challenge that I found to be difficult.
Yeah. And that, so let me explain kind of physiologically what I think is happening there. So isn't it interesting that there are a lot of people in the world who go the longest period of time that they will in a day without eating, which is from dinner or dessert to, you know, breakfast, and they are waking up. I mean, that's at least 8 hours, and they're not hungry, which, you know, it's not because they ate a really big dinner. I mean, sometimes people say that to me, but I'm like, well, you could eat a really big lunch and you would still be hungry at dinner. We do that at Thanksgiving. At least I do. I have big Thanksgiving dinner. And then, you know, we do it at noon, and, you know, sure enough, 8 o'clock, I still need food, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But so part of what happens is that people have dinner at 6 or 7, and then they have ice cream or maybe a glass of wine, and a glass of wine is carbohydrates. And so their blood sugar goes up and comes back down, and insulin goes up and comes back down to store it. And then by midnight, like, the blood glucose is pretty low, but because we're not thinking anymore, we're not doing this high level of thinking, because we're now doing more thinking than we did certainly 100 years ago, let alone 10,000 years ago. The brain's like, we're good. We don't have to think very hard. And what happens is, so a couple of things can happen, is one, in that scenario, then people can have what I call the 3 a.m. committee meeting, which is when they wake up in the mid to early mornings, and the committee, which is those voices in our heads that are like, oh, he said, she said, and we should have done this, and he should have done that. And there's always that voice that's like, holy crap, I'm still awake, right? And it usually lasts 2 hours before you go back to sleep for your alarm to go off. So that is a hypoglycemic event where the blood glucose got too low, the brain hit the, oh my God, the bear's in the room, the adrenaline button, and woke the entire committee up in order to make fuel, and then the fuel gets made, and then the brain has to get the fuel, and then the adrenaline has to be put back, you know, has to be broken down and out of the system, and then you get to go back to sleep. Some people will sleep through that, and then they will wake up, but they still have adrenaline in the system, and they're not hungry, because evolution or God, I don't really care who decided this, but when we have a lot of adrenaline in our system, we're not hungry. That didn't make sense when you're running from the bear and going, I think I'm really hungry. And so when we're not hungry when we should be, that means that there's adrenaline in the system. And what I have people do when they're waking in the early morning and at either 3 a.m. or when they want to wake up in the morning and they're not hungry is I have them have a quarter cup of fruit juice, just a little bit of fruit juice, and a handful of nuts so that the juice will go to their brain. So the brain will go, oh, okay, I got some fuel. We're okay. And we'll take our foot off the panic button. And then the nuts are a slow burning fuel that will come in later. And so I suspect if you wanted to change the pattern, and if the pattern's not bothering you, you don't have to change it. But if the pattern's bothering you, if you drank a quarter cup of fruit juice in the morning, just as, like, I have people just leave it at the bedstand. So as they're getting up in the morning, they just put it in their mouth so that within usually about a half hour, the body is really going, hey, we burnt the fuel that you just gave us, the juice, and we need some more. Does that make sense?
That's a delightful suggestion. Your explanation, too, of what's happening in the morning makes really good sense to me. It really was 3 hours this morning before I really ate anything at all. When Deborah said, well, how was last night for you? My answer was, somebody was chasing me all night long. In my imagination. I just remember all night long working to get away from whatever this entity was. So it makes sense that I was generating lots of adrenaline and was not really quite ready to do anything when I actually got up. So I'll take your suggestion seriously and try that tomorrow.
Right. And, and since you know that you're not waking up at 3 a.m., running from whatever's going on.
No, it's a whole night thing. Yeah.
If you happen to wake up to go to pee, like, that would also be a time so that, you know, for people with mental health challenges like post-traumatic stress disorder, they would call, some of those nightmares would be in the form of flashbacks.
Right.
And so one of the things that I will do with people who are having flashbacks is have them eat a couple slices of turkey before going to bed. And what that does is that puts a slow-burning fuel for the liver to eat on while you're asleep, and that will often keep the 3 a.m. waking or the nightmares away.
We have a couple of comments that were written in the chat room that I want to read to you, Dr. Allitt. It says, first of all, quote, really appreciating the clear exposition by the guest, which is a wonderful thing.
Great. I'm glad it's clear. I haven't done, I usually have props, and so I'm a little nervous about not having props, so I'm glad it's clear.
The second comment is, Kristen Allitt is cracking me up. I am in the same boat. No trouble sleeping, but I do wait for an hour or two before eating, usually. This morning it was maybe 3 hours. My iPad and I were all snuggled up and responding to emails. I'll try getting up instead.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your comments. And I would welcome questions, either people writing in or calling in, because sometimes it's nice to get your question answered.
So there's your invitation. There is a chat room here on the radio show page, so you can write your questions in there, and I'll see them on the screen. Or you can call in. If you're in a country other than the United States, you can use Skype for free. The guest call-in number is 347-945-5358. It is true, some of my shows are recorded, but Kristen today is a guest who is live, so that you'll be able to actually ask her whatever questions you might have. I want to be sure and be clear about exactly what you're recommending with regard to the 3 a.m. waking that can be a problem in terms of aggregating fatigue. So as I understand it, one of the suggestions is right before you go to bed, you have some turkey. Is that right?
Some turkey. It could be any kind of meat, but turkey has a little more tryptophan in it, and so tryptophan helps make serotonin and then melatonin. So I'm basically spiking it by recommending turkey. Some people have been taught by the diet industry not to eat before they go to bed, and we're not talking about binging on turkey. What we're talking about is like two slices of turkey. And that's going to keep your blood sugar stable for a longer period of time. And then if you do wake up at 3 a.m., put on the bedstand a quarter cup of fruit juice and a handful of nuts. And you just, if you wake up, and I do this because I go through periods where I will have 3 a.m. waking because I travel nationally to speak on food and mood. And when I'm in the wrong time zone, my body will signal that it's time to get up, and it's hungry because I'm on another time zone. And so I will just put a quarter cup of fruit juice and a handful of nuts by my bedstand. And what that does, and I will consume it if I wake up at 3 a.m. And if I don't wake up at 3 a.m., I will consume it the minute I sit up so that my body knows that we are now in an awakened state and that I'm going to fuel it so that I can start making decisions in my day.
A companion number that listeners can call is the toll-free number 877-590-0733. Again, if you live in a country outside the United States, you can access that number or the previous number I gave you through Skype. Many people who are listening to this currently experience symptoms of Parkinson's or have a loved one who does. Will the tools and the suggestions that you have for anxiety, depression, and fatigue be helpful also to individuals who currently experience the symptoms of Parkinson's?
Well, to be very honest, I haven't treated a lot of individuals with Parkinson's, and so but prior to coming on the show, I did some research and I consulted with a naturopathic physician who I know who works a lot here in Washington with Parkinson's. And one of the things that is challenging in Parkinson's is that when people are on L-DOPA, the recommendation, or at least the recommendations that I read, was to eat a low-protein diet, because what people have found is that when the amino acids are competing to get across the blood-brain barrier, it can alter the amount of medication that's getting across the blood-brain barrier, and so, which causes the medication to be not as effective. And so, what I would hypothesize then is, and what my experience has been with other conditions, is that there would be a higher degree of low-grade anxiety if people are eating a low-protein diet throughout the day. And so there's a balance that I wonder, and again, I would be happy for people to write in and respond to this. There's this balance between eating small, frequent meals with protein in it and not having the shaking and having more anxiety. Do you know, Robert, about that?
Well, you might want to say some more about that.
Yes, I
am very aware of that, and that is a huge issue for people with Parkinson's, and they struggle with the issue, the balance between taking the cinnamon and the issue of protein. It's a terrible challenge for many people.
It is a terrible challenge, and I was as I was doing my research, it made me very concerned and compassionate about how people balance that, because the symptoms of Parkinson's, they want to keep as low as possible. However, when people remove protein from their major meals, what does that leave? That leaves carbohydrates, right? And carbohydrates can come in the form of vegetables, or it can, and grains like quinoa, or it can come in the form of pasta and breads. And what I would suspect is that if, you know, the people, the more they ate real food, like vegetables and grains like rice and quinoa, with those foods, because there's so much fiber in it, the sugar is not going to hit their system as hard and fast as compared to eating a piece of toast. And so what I would suspect, and again, I wish I had more experience, and I regret that I can't offer experience, but I can explain the physiology as I understand it, is that by eating more complex carbs, people are going to have less anxiety if they're going to choose to eat a low-protein diet. And it becomes even more important, and I think with any neurological condition, it's very important to be eating as many real foods as possible, just for the nutrients. But the recommendations that I've read and that I consulted with is that they protein at night so that they can get their protein in, and that's going to be a very challenging way of doing it. But that's why what I was recommending is I see is more for the caregivers in terms of managing their anxiety. But I'm not sure there's a very tough balance that's going to have to be made with somebody who's in Parkinson's in terms of getting enough protein in so that they can support their muscle mass, so that they can not be anxious, so that they can have amino acids to make dopamine and serotonin so that they're not depressed, and support all the biological needs, and so that the medications are most effective. And as I was listening to your summit and the research that I did prior to coming on the show, I suspect that that is also going to be mediated by what the initiating cause is of Parkinson's. And Parkinson's is sort of an umbrella diagnosis with lots of different causes, and so that people's tolerance will probably be based on where the cause is coming from, is my suspect. But again, I don't have enough clinical experience to know for sure.
We have a question that's been written here in the chat room. Quote, "I don't get tired at night. That's my problem. I am not very good in the morning, but improve as the day progresses. By midnight, I am having a good time, usually. Then it's tough to put myself down for sleep, so I think my cortisol is upside down. So what can I do about that?"
Well, the person who wrote in that they know that cortisol is probably the driver is very smart. That's a good guess. There's a couple of things. So in terms of behaviors, when somebody comes in and is sort of a night owl versus a morning person, the first thing I assess is, does it matter? Because there are a lot of people who don't need to be a bright-eyed and bushy-tailed at 8 a.m., and they can go to bed at midnight and get up at 9 a.m. or go to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning and get up at noon, and it doesn't have consequence to their life. And if that's true, I'm like, well, I would go with it, because there are people who are just inherently night owls. Now, if that is not the case, what I tell people is, to me, so therapists talk about the inner child, and I talk about the child, which is the body. And if we treat the body as though it's a three-year-old, we will have much happier bodies, just like you would have a happier three-year-old. And one of the things that three-year-olds need is structure. And so what's the things that are really important for the body to be able to predict is going to bed and getting up. And the other is when it's going to get fed. And so when people are having a hard time going to bed, it's kind of like that the three-year-old who's standing there at, you know, and is in their jammies, and they're like, I don't want to go to bed. You're just like, dude, you're so tired. Just close your mouth and lay down. You will go to sleep. And our bodies can get that like that with all the stimulation that is available to us. When I talk to people about what their night ritual is, it usually looks something like this. They come home, they have dinner at 7. If they have kids, they do homework and get the kids into bed. And then they go open up their email to see what disaster is happening tomorrow at work. And then they sit down or lay down on their bed and watch CSI and 5 people get murdered. And then they wonder why they can't go to sleep. And so what I have people do is if they need to be up at 7 o'clock, then they need to be going to bed probably by 11, and which means by 10, they need to really start winding down the stimulation, and ideally even before that. And so what I have some nieces and nephews who are between the ages of 3 and 5, and their mother is really good about, you know, you have dinner, you get in your jammies, you read a couple of books, then you go to bed. And that's the structure every night. And that's what I encourage people to do when they're trying to get their body to settle down at night, is I tell everybody above the age of 15 the following statement. Beds are for sleep and sex. And not reading, not watching murders, not eating, not all of those things, because then we're giving the body mixed signals about what it should be doing in bed. And so if somebody wants to go to bed earlier, I help them create a ritual about going to bed and also just lower the stimuli to pretty boring, so that they can actually feel how tired they are. And then set the schedule, and it usually takes a couple of weeks. And our minds, the committee that talks to us, is going to be pretty annoyed that we are in this pattern. But what happens is people will, when they set the pattern, then they will go to bed a little more easily. About 6 months ago, 6-9 months ago, I'm actually pretty good. So if you're sleeping well, you can watch CSI and you can read books. But if you're having problems sleeping, then you need to sort of rein it in a little. But just out of curiosity, I stopped watching murders before I go to bed just to see what happened. And I have to say that after about 3 months of not watching the really heavy murders on television that are available, I am much happier, and I like people a lot more than I did. And, when we watch TV, our brain is practicing that. And sometimes we need to ask, is that what we want to practice? So, anyway, is that cover the sleep?
I think that does that beautifully. Okay. For the person that actually wrote in that question, and they said, aha. So I think that means, yeah, that sounds like a good suggestion for them. We've had several people who called in and indicated they wanted to ask questions, but we lost them on the control panel. So please feel free to call back to that very same toll-free number or number in the U.S. The toll-free number is 877-590-0733, or the other number is 347-945-5358, and we'd be delighted to connect you in with Dr. Allitt. And I'm going to connect a person in.
Okay.
Right now. Area code 510, you are on the air.
Oh, great. Hi.
Hi.
I'm the person laughing in the text.
Oh, great.
My name is Bob, and I'm just cracking up for a couple of reasons, one of which is that you sound exactly like a colleague of mine, and I can't believe it's not her. So that is very strange, but you were separated at birth, I guess.
Well, it's a big, I'll take it as a compliment.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, my friend Carrie, she's great. Anyway, yes, about the murders. Right.
Right.
Yeah, I'm watching a lot of TV series on, you know, and I can watch them on my iPad, so more snuggling up in bed and watching at least mysteries, if not murders. But there's usually a murder involved in a mystery somewhere. Anyway, so I am a night owl, and I guess I know my mother was. And I probably learned it early, like in the womb. And so I've been doing that for a long time. And the advice to start deactivation, you know, maybe around midnight or maybe even before, is a good idea. So, and I've heard it before because I've gone to the Stanford Sleep Clinic a couple times for overnights, and they determined that I had sleep apnea, which was one big problem with my sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to my being prescribed a CPAP machine, which I hated. And then I got another thing, an oral appliance, you know, like a retainer that adjusted jaw so the tongue wouldn't fall back.
Yep.
So I use that instead. It's a little complicated because I'm a mouth breather, so then I had to figure out to put tape over my lips. So the whole project of going to sleep is rather comical with an eye mask, earplugs, a gadget in my mouth and tape over my lips.
Wow.
Yeah.
So do you have a question?
Yes, I have a question. I also, this all came about from initially, like 3 or 4, maybe 5 years before I was diagnosed with Parkinson's, I was diagnosed with Lyme disease. And saying that, you know, Parkinsonism can be triggered from, who knows how many different potential causes and variables. But in my case, at least, it looks as though there was a simultaneous or pre-existing condition of infection by not only bacteria, the Borrelia burgdorferi, but also other things such as a high Epstein-Barr virus, 7 times elevated over normal, and protomyxoa and some Ehrlichia, potentially Babesia. And so I have a port now, and so I'm doing lots of IVs with various antibiotics and whatnot. I was curious if in your reading you had anything to say about the, the comorbidity of Lyme and associated disorders and Parkinson's.
Well, I don't have any... I don't have any scientific research suggesting it. What I do know is that the immune system is a very, it's like the monitoring system for the world. I mean, really, our body is its world. And we see a number of different infections that can have impact on the nervous system. Without any Western research, one of the things that one of the tools that I use with great success is Chinese medicine to work with the brain as well as the immune system. Have you done any Chinese medicine or acupuncture?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have, and I was actually seeing an acupuncturist who has Parkinson's disease. He's since retired, so now I'm working with another practitioner.
And do you find it helpful?
A couple of times he's hit the spot, and then all the trembling and the shaking stuff, inner sensation of trembling, all that just vaporized. It was quite amazing. He said, well, he had hit the right spot for the vagal nerve or something to
right
deactivate. In general, I'd say no, and I have tried so many different things, you wouldn't believe it, including 42 sessions of hyperbaric oxygen. And
oh, yeah, so you've done the whole gamut.
I'm currently doing intravenous glutathione and sodium phenylbutyrate and
excellent.
Phosphatidylcholine and all that. It's the Patricia Kane protocol.
Yep.
He's back east in Philadelphia. So I'm waiting to see if that has some benefit.
That makes sense to me. Yep. That makes sense
far,
to me.
So far what has worked the best, unfortunately, is combination of L-DOPA and arcane and gabapentin.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, you know, the, I mean, you will know more about the disease than I do. I mean, that I will be the first to admit that. It's, you know, the, what I know about chronic diseases and people successfully managing chronic diseases, doing exactly what you're doing, is going to as many people as you can get a hold of and taking the best of what they have to offer you and putting it together. And because with complex chronic diseases, and I don't care if it's Parkinson's, asthma, or mental health issues, complex mental health issues, is no one is going to have the exact same, the exact protocol for any one person. The body is far too complex, and the brain particularly. I mean, there's 100 billion connections in the brain. I mean, you can't even, you know, think about how big of a how many connections there are. And so, you know, the people who I've worked with chronic illness, who, you know, go to each provider and notice what is the 10% that really helped, and write that down and keep it. And what was the 10% this other person really helped, and write that down and keep it. One of the people who taught me this was a best friend of mine who had severe asthma, and her parents were like told that she was going to die before she turned 30, and the meds got enough better, and that's exactly what she did. Is she went to each provider for a year. She's like, I will do exactly what you tell me to do for a year, and then I'm moving on. And she figured out the right combination, you know, of eliminating certain food allergies, which would be certainly something that I bet you've tried, or people should try with Parkinson's. Making sure that they don't have gluten intolerance, making sure that they're not sensitive to lactose, because those are the two easiest. And then going to a Chinese practitioner and figuring out what is the point. Okay, this point is really good. And maybe going to a cranial sacral specialist. I have one friend who does cranial sacral, and she can at least control the tremors when they're on the table, which is at least an hour of relief. And it's an hour of practicing not trembling. And so you develop this toolkit that you can implement as needed. Now, is that going to be the cure? I don't know. But are you going to have a series of tools that you can employ based on if your insurance is going to pay for it, this, you know, at the beginning of the year or at the end of the year? Because that's often a factor with chronic disease. You know, you have a tool set that you can build upon that is uniquely you. And, you know, on the grand level, and then I'll stop talking, but on the grand level, I think that, you know, part of why we're here, regardless if you're spiritual or not, is to discover what is uniquely yours. And chronic illness is always that path of discovering what is unique about you and what is only yours. And what makes you feel better in the world and feel empowered in the world, and what does not. And that's the path that I encourage my patients with chronic mental health problems to do, and what I would that you're clearly doing. And so, congratulations.
Well, thank you, and very beautifully put, I must say. Well, coincidentally, I've just returned from Washington State, where I was on a 7-day silent meditation retreat, and then there was a conference here in the Bay Area that I attended called the Science and Non-Duality Conference, that I'm sort of a sub-coordinator of. So I'm very busy in the spiritual side of life. And living in Berkeley, it's a mecca, you know, for alternative health practitioners.
Sure.
So a lot of people are making a lot of money off of my curiosity. And I guess one of them is, who isn't making much money, but she's been very helpful, is Bianca, whom Robert knows, who is a Qigong teacher who cured herself of Parkinson's. And she'll be presenting at the summit in Santa Fe.
Excellent.
Later this month, I believe.
Oh, it's in February.
I'm sorry. No wonder I was confused. I was going to ask you why would you put Thanksgiving right in the middle of summit? Okay. Well, there's a little bit of the what I call Swiss cheese brain from Lyme disease acting up again. Thank you. The combination, what would you call it? A personalized tool bag of different tricks and dietary things and allopathic things and naturopathic things. It does get a little complicated if one doesn't keep a diary, and having a single list of this is the 10% that worked from this, that, and the other is a very good idea. So thank you for that.
Wonderful. Thank you, Bob, so much for calling.
Thank you, Bob.
Asking your question.
Thank you for calling. Thank you for sharing.
You're welcome.
Sharing.
Area code. Area code 9937. You're on the air. Hello.
Thank you for calling. Thank you for sharing.
Hello. Area code 937.
Yes, I'm here.
You're on the air. Hi.
I'm here.
It sounds like your radio needs to be turned off because I can hear it in the background.
Yeah, I'm. I lost my husband in October of 10.
Radio needs to be turned off because I can hear it in the background. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah,
am I on the air?
Yes,
you are.
There's just a little delay.
I lost my husband in October of 07. October of 10, and I was diagnosed 19 months later with Parkinson's, and so I think depression is sort of a natural kind of thing for me. I get up and get out of bed, and that's probably the hardest part of my day. And I go to the gym every day, or at least 5-6 days a week I go to the gym.
Excellent.
And I try to follow a gluten-free diet, and now I'm being told I should not eat dairy, and then all of a sudden it's like you don't eat, watch your protein. I don't know what, I feel like I've got this sea of information. I'm starting to see an acupuncturist.
Great.
And he's a wonderful acupuncturist, and I'm just starting with him.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's so many directions to take, and I feel sort of scattered a bit. And I want to get centered again in my life.
Right.
I'm considered underweight by most of the physicians that I see. So I do enjoy having protein in a meal because I do think you're right. I think I do feel better and do better when I have protein.
Right. And, that's one of the things that you'll need to work out with your physician on, depending on,
Go ahead.
And And so, but I can hear the overwhelm, like, you know, how many directions do I go and what do I know for sure is working? And that's where I think that it's really worth, one of the things that the brain does not like is the unknown, as you well know. Like, it doesn't, when it doesn't know if it needs to make a decision or today or not, it anticipates that it has to make a decision, and so it keeps coming back to it. And so what I tell people is, you know, to set in the calendar, okay, we're going to do 3 months of gluten-free and be really good about it. And we're going to track our symptoms before and after.
Uh-huh.
And then we're going to challenge it a little and see what happens. And then, quite honestly, we're going to ask ourselves, is it worth it? Because it's a big deal to keep weight out of one's diet. And some people, they're like, I like it too much. I've worked with people who, for instance, are diabetic, and they're like, I like it too much. I know it's driving the diabetes, and I'm going to do it anyway. And I'm like, okay, but at least they made an informed choice. And so, you know, by getting clear that gluten is either in or out, then you can say, okay, it's in or out, and here are the decisions that I'm going to make around it. Like, maybe you'll cheat on somebody's birthday and then go back to gluten-free.
Right. It's about what I do.
You know, because sometimes you just have to cheat. It's not the greatest, but if you know what the consequences are and you're willing to pay it, it's your body and your life.
Right.
And then with the acupuncturist, I would do the same thing. I would go into the acupuncturist and say, and what I tell people, particularly with alternative medicine people, is go in 3 times and see if you are better or curious. Now, with Parkinson's, probably better is not going to happen in 3 appointments. If it does, keep going. But curious might be there. And curious might come up because maybe the trembling's still there, but
uh-huh.
You get off the table and you feel better within yourself.
I did the first time, yeah.
You know, okay, we're going to keep trying. But then,
right.
You know, marking your calendar, like, okay, we're going to go to this they pass the 3-appointment test, and now, you know, you're going to say, you know, sometimes with health insurance you've got 12 appointments, and so that's just going to be your criteria. It's a random criteria. Okay, and the acupuncturist has 3 appointments or 12 appointments to really see what's possible. And then
right.
You're going to be at a new cutoff line where you're like, okay, insurance is no longer paying for this, and so I'm going to have to decide. I'm not going to decide until I get there if it's worth it because I don't know what the results are. Now, if it's keeping you from trembling for a couple of days, that might be worth it.
Yeah,
right? because you're just getting your body to practice, to not practice that, right?
Right.
And then if you're not getting results or you're not getting enough results, kind of write up a summary and say, this is what acupuncturist did for me. And say to your acupuncturist, thanks so much for the information. I'll probably be back through, but I'm going to go explore something else. I'm going
right.
to go do cranial sacral because, you know, somebody said that helped them. And you're only going to take on the projects that you feel that you can add into your own life
okay.
and that you can be consistent with it so that you can actually see if it's helping. And because if you're overwhelmed by the plethora of therapies out there, you're adding stress.
Exactly, exactly. Yes.
We don't want to add stress.
Yeah,
right?
I'm feeling like I need to be doing this and I need to be doing that. Somebody suggested, you know, I feel like I need to try 15 things at
right.
once.
And there may,
then
you
I'm
know,
not
you might
fettered
be able,
when I do that.
Right. And you might be able to do 2 things at the same time because they're working on different levels. They're working
right.
on, you know, it might be like, okay, I'm going to try CoQ10 and acupuncture at the same time. Well, you probably won't know what's most effective if things get better, right? But
That's
if things
true.
Get better, you're going to kind of keep things in place and, you know, decide if you have to know, because I have patients who come in and we do multiple therapies at the same time, and they don't know what's making it better, but they're just going to keep steady state for a while because they're feeling better. Like, it doesn't matter to them because they're feeling better. Other people, like, they really want to know what's making it. And so we have to very systematically add new things in. And everybody has a different personality. This is what I was talking about in terms of really discovering, making this path about a path of discovery for who you are and who you want to become as much as a path about treating Parkinson's.
Well, I think I know. I'm a portrait artist, and I want to continue to paint and do charcoal portraits. And having a right hand that tremors a lot makes it a lot more challenging, I'll tell you that.
Absolutely.
And I feel like that's, I'm ready to give up the rest of what I do, which is it's not that important anymore. And I want to continue with the portrait work. Not so much for love, but not so much for money, but for love.
Excellent. And keeping in with the portraits and loving what you can do with who you are, with the tremble or without the tremble, and loving that is going to be more significant than giving it up.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's not the you that you used to be, and you don't want to be this person now. Right? I mean, that's the fear.
Right.
Is that people will give up what they love because it's not the same. They want to be back before the Parkinson's took over.
I want to be as good as I always was, and I still have that. I still want my skills to be as good as they were.
Absolutely. And your skills may change into something else.
Right. I may have to have a looser look.
You might have a looser look. I study with a physician by the name of Dan Siegel, and you can find him at drdansiegel.com. He's got great language around brain and mind stuff. But he had the opportunity here in Seattle to talk to the Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama asked him to go come back and tell him what a secular ethic is that all human beings on this planet would agree to. And I thought to myself, I'm glad that the Dalai Lama is not asking me that question, because I'm just not that broad of a thinker to come up with that.
Let me think about that for a minute.
But
go
what
ahead.
Dan said was what all humans can agree on is that they want to be healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Every single one of us would agree to that. And then the Dalai Lama, part of the Dalai Lama's question was, by what mechanism can you scientifically always prove that moves us towards health? And he said compassion and self-compassion.
Mm.
And I find that to be absolutely true, is that when we can be self-compassionate for what we can do in the moment and who we are in the moment, life is better and we are healthier.
You're right.
I actually have a thought for you, too. I am editing my new book called Language of Recovery. I am always then on the alert for the words that people use when they convey their intentions. I heard you use the words want to. I want to return to doing what I love, which is portrait painting. I recommend you delete those words, want to.
Because I am.
And change the words, not want to, but I love portrait painting. I love portrait painting. In other words, assert it as something that you're doing now. You'll see a remarkable shift by simply changing the language.
Thank you. You're very right. Thank you. Thank you for that beautiful piece of advice. Yeah, that feels like it fits, Robert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you.
Telling
thanks
us all about
my call.
What's up for you. Have a marvelous day.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Dr. Allitt, tell us what, again, the benefits of eating enough protein are.
So, yeah, so the benefits from the last caller, like one of the things to work out with a physician and maybe work out with a nutritionist is, you know, how do I do my diet? Because people will get to a point where with their meds they need to reduce the protein in their diet. But if they're not to that stage yet, what I would recommend is that they wake up in the morning and have breakfast that has a little bit of protein in it. So this could be eggs, this could be quinoa. Quinoa is a grain that's much higher in protein than rice or oats. This could be some chicken sausage, some kind of protein. And then within an hour of waking, and then maybe a handful of nuts 3 or 4 hours later, could be also cottage cheese or nut butter. And then maybe a slice of meat for most people, unless they're of a pretty slight frame, a deck of cards size of meat is kind of what they're looking for. And you want to make sure you're getting some veggies in at lunch as well. Vegetables are going to be really important in terms of antioxidants and fiber and all those things, but we're looking for the protein. And then maybe, you know, 3 p.m., a handful of nuts again. And then dinner, whatever we're having with dinner, you know, meat or beans and quinoa or tofu for dinner. And then if we're having sleep issues, make sure that we have a little bit of protein before we go to bed. If we want to spike it, we want to do turkey. Putting a little juice besides the bedstand, just a quarter cup of juice, because we don't want to do a lot of juice, because otherwise we're going to get hypoglycemic really quick. And then a handful of nuts. Or we'll wake up, if we're not morning breakfast eaters, we'll try that to see if we can get our morning breakfast eaters. The other thing that I haven't mentioned that I'll just add in is that if you ever find yourself really anxious about something, please eat and see if that is part of what's driving it. If the anxiety has gotten too high and you just can't cope, that's the time to get a little bit of juice and a handful of nuts to just see that if in 10, 15 minutes, if the anxiety is less.
On the Parkinson's Recovery blog, I have posted some additional information provided by Dr. Allitt about protein, the benefits of eating enough of it, and how much you should actually eat, and then very specific lists of proteins that are healthy. There's also some information that ties your weight to the amount total that you should eat every day. For example, I see their weights from 100 to 200, and when I look at the weight 160, which is my weight, my target protein every day is 64 grams, and the acceptable range is 57 to 72. You can then go on the blog, and you can look, according to your weight, at exactly how much would be the preferred amount of protein and exactly what that might look like. Can a person eat too much protein in a day?
So too much protein for me is over 120 grams per day. So a deck of cards, a piece of meat the size of a deck of cards, is 20 grams of protein. And so so that would be 6 decks of cards of, say, chicken. That's a lot of protein. So sometimes I do that when people are looking at weight loss programs, that there's a lot of benefit in terms of having a higher protein diet. I should say that some people think that this is a high protein diet that I'm recommending, which is 8 grams per 20 pounds of body weight, which is really standard RDA amounts of protein. There's something called sarcopenia, which in the elderly is muscle wasting and is the main contributor to people falling down and having problems getting up again. and they double the amount of protein that I'm recommending. So this is an abnormal amount of protein. One of the challenges, again, that I would recommend somebody with Parkinson's sit down with their physician or sit down with a nutritionist to work out is that sometimes I have, typically men do this, is that they're, oh, I'm eating plenty of protein. I'm eating a 10-ounce steak every night for dinner. Well, the problem with that is 3 of those ounces are going to go to your metabolism and the other 7 ounces is going to go to fat. And so how I understand physiology, breaking the protein out throughout the day is really helpful in terms of not only managing blood glucose, but also getting your protein values in. And so, again, I think individualizing what and doing experiments with the Parkinson's patient is going to be really important. And I hope that I am not frustrating people or making people anxious by giving these cross messages. For the caregivers, it certainly would be helpful to be consistent and broken out throughout the day. Does that make sense, Robert?
It does indeed.
Okay.
Many people, when they think of protein, equate that with meat. In the information that you provided that's now posted on the Parkinson's Recovery blog, there is just a delightful chart I'm looking at right now that lists other sources of healthy protein in the areas of vegetables, seed grains, dairy substitutes, nuts, milk products, eggs, and then there's even an other category. So be sure and access that rich information, which is available on the blog, posted October the 30th, 2012. For example, for seed grains, you have listed quinoa, barley, dark rye, flour, millet, oats, brown rice, white rice. For dairy substitutes, there's soy milk, soy cheese, soy yogurt. So there are many alternatives for a person that might say, well, I just can't do the protein thing because I don't eat meat. It sounds like what you're also saying is if that's your choice, there are alternatives that aren't meat-based. Would that be correct?
That is true. And one of the things, though, that is that I point out to patients is that cheese and milk do in my how I recommend things to my patients do not count as a protein source. And I was just did a talk in Wisconsin, and they were very upset about that statement.
I bet.
And we kept having to review it. Now, I am not against dairy in the diet, unless you're sensitive to it. I really enjoy my cheese and milk, which is why I know that Wisconsin has very good cheese. But I don't count it as a protein source. And the reason why I don't count it as a protein source is that I have had a number of what I call pasta dairy vegetarians come into my office who are quite anxious and really protein deficient, even though they're eating, you know, drinking like a gallon of milk, which theoretically should have enough protein in it. And I think what is happening is that there is a wide degree of lactose intolerance in the population, and either they're lactose intolerant or they're overwhelming the enzymes that they have and the protein's not being absorbed because the lactose is not being broken down properly. And so I generally, for the vegetarians, I encourage them to use quinoa or tofu or protein powders or tempeh or beans and rice, but they're protein sources and not cheese or milk. Now, cottage cheese and high-protein yogurt seem to work just fine. And part of it is that the lactose is much lower in those products.
I've just discovered a yogurt that's made out of coconut, which I absolutely love.
Oh, I will have to look into that. Is there a protein in it?
They mix it usually with strawberries or blueberries or raspberries, and I've also seen them with almond milk as well. So in terms of protein, I'm not sure, but it certainly is yummy to eat.
Yeah,
and
I bet it's high in fat. It should be yummy for the fat content.
That's right. That's probably why
now,
I like it so much.
Yeah. Now, the almond milks and hazelnut milks don't have much protein in it. You actually have to look at the label to see how much protein in it. A lot of people assume that those are high in protein, and they are really sugar water. Lovely to have in your coffee if you're not eating dairy, but nevertheless not a protein source.
That's interesting. What is your website?
My website is Dynamic Paths. That's dynamic, and then it's like small little roads, paths, P-A-T-H-S, it's plural, .com. And I also have a Facebook site, which is at facebook.com/dynamicpaths.com, or Dynamic Paths. I'm sure you can just type it in and find me, or you can find it off my website. And I believe that you've posted it kindly for me as well. I'm located, my private practice is in Seattle, Washington. So if anyone's listening from Seattle, Washington, that is good information. Sometimes I do talks in the Seattle area. And then I speak nationally for PESI. They kind of have a different, it's PESI.com is where you'd find it, P-E-S-I. And so I will be going to the Chicago area in February.
I do know that you make talks and speeches all over the United States and the world for that matter, but you also, as I understand it, then are accepting new patients.
I am accepting new patients in the Seattle area. I don't consult with people over the phone. I only see people who can come to my office.
Is there an email where people can get in touch?
My email is Allott, A-L-L-O-T-T, at dynamicpaths.com.
And then for those of you who want that spelled out, the website as well as the end of the email address is www.dynamicpaths.com. That's spelled DYNAMICPATHS.com. Dr. Allott, if there's one thing that you would like listeners to this show to take away with them, what would it be?
Well, I think the one thing that the guest brought up is when we're overwhelmed with the options and the unknown, making a choice to focus on a detail for a certain amount of time and seeing what it gets you really is helpful to move forward. Because, you know, for me, the thing that I don't want to do in my life is get stuck. And sometimes I have to, make some decisions to move forward, and they may or may not build fruit, but at least I am making the choice to try, and try in a way that doesn't overwhelm me. That's really what I would have people focus on, is make a choice to go down a path for a period of time and then see what it gets them, and then take the 10% of the best that they get. I think that would be helpful.
Dr. Kristen Allott, I want to thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for all of these wonderful suggestions that you've given to individuals for what they can do to address issues of anxiety and depression as they emerge throughout the day.
Well, I really appreciate you inviting me, and I want to thank the people who called and wrote in and the people who just absorbed the information coming in. Thank you so much for participating.
Well, and I thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I want to say, although I said this already, her ideas really have had a large impact on my own energy level and life. Those little bouts of depression in the afternoon are no longer creeping in because I'm more mindful of how I am eating throughout the day, and I am more attentive of making sure that I get enough protein so that I don't slip out in this zone of effortlessness and fatigue and depression that's really been creeping in my entire life from 2 o'clock until 4:30 every afternoon.